Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.
Hello and welcome to Wireless, a series all about radio broadcast on Flirt FM 101.3 in Galway and on flirtfm.ie. I'm John Walsh and I'll be with you for the next hour. Wireless covers all aspects of radio, analogue and digital broadcasting, community, regional and national broadcasters, niche broadcasting, pirate radio, podcasting, radio ownership and radio's history and future prospects. Coming up on the May edition of Wireless, The Cat with Nine Lives, RTE's long-wave radio service gets yet another reprieve. A new book on the history of Irish radio is launched, memories of County Louth pirate station Boyneside Radio, and we bring you reports from two radio and audio festivals held recently in Ireland.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
RTE's long-wave radio service has been given yet another extension following several attempts to close it down in recent years. Chair of the Oireachtas Communications Committee, Galway Deputy Hildegard Nocton, recently announced that the service on 252 kHz was to continue for at least another 2 years following a letter that she received from the RTE Director General Dee Forbes. Deputy Nocton added that she had been told by RTE that a major upgrade on the transmission equipment was required and that the service could be off the air for up to 10 weeks as a result. 2 years ago on this programme, we reported that RTE intended to set up several local DAB services in UK cities with a view to ensuring continuity of service to the Irish population there. However, Deputy Nocton was told by RTE that Ofcom, the UK communications regulator, would not allow them to broadcast on digital at this time. And Deputy Nocton joins me on the phone now. You're very welcome.
Thank you.
So I'd like to begin by asking you to give us a little bit about the background to the committee's work on this issue.
So, as you know, in 2014, RTE announced the closure of long-wave radio, and listeners in the UK, particularly elderly Irish emigrants, were very concerned about this because they rely on RTE as their link with home, and it's their link, it's the diaspora link, really, to Ireland. So several thousand people signed petitions and they contacted politicians, and that closure was delayed until 2017. I was elected to the Éireann in 2016 and I became chairperson of this Oireachtas committee, the communications committee. And again, concerns are raised to me as chair of the committee, and I contacted RTE in relation to this, in relation to the continuation of that long wave service. So last week, the Director General of RTE, Dee Forbes, committed to continuing the long wave service for a minimum of 2 years, and that upgrade works would have to be carried out in order to ensure that transmission would continue.
And I do have to declare an interest here, Deputy Nocton, in that I did make a representation to the committee myself. I felt in particular that it was concerning in the context of Brexit that the last remaining analogue link, a radio link to the UK, would be lost. Did that issue, was that issue important for your committee as well?
Yes, it was very concerning in relation to keeping that link open between the UK and Ireland and many of our diaspora who rely on this service for information and for their connection to what's happening here at home in Ireland. And because the UK regulator won't grant RTE that the necessary license in order to broadcast in digital on a digital platform in the UK, we need to start looking at alternatives, and that's something that my committee will be looking at going into the future in relation to continuing this service.
And I know from talking to the Keep Longwave 252 campaign that parliamentary questions to the Minister for Communications have been ruled out of order on this matter because of the independence of RTE from government. Has that had a negative impact on the work of the committee?
I'm not familiar with those particular parliamentary questions, but our committee has I suppose part of our remit would be to call in RTE in relation to their programme, what they're doing. It's a remit or an oversight role from our committee in relation to RTE. So we would bring in RTE regularly before our committee. So we'll be doing that in relation to this also. And I think it's positive that the long wave services to continue and that upgrade, those upgrade works will commence. I understand from the correspondence from RTE is that they will be commenced in mid-September and they will be carried out for a number of weeks. So we have the ability as a committee to bring in RTE and to ensure that this service continues. They say it's for a minimum of 2 years, but we also need to look at other alternatives that are there in relation to ensuring that this critical service continues.
And have you any active intention at the moment to look for further clarification from RTE on any of the issues in their letter?
Well, they have stated that these works will commence in mid-September. These are what they describe as quite specialist works, and they're high-risk works that need to take place. The mast at Summerhill is 240 metres in height, and they call it high-risk work, a high-risk work environment. So, and they say that the works will be dependent on weather, in particular wind speeds will determine the duration of those upgrade works. They say that the service will be temporarily suspended for 10 weeks, so I think it's important that listeners are aware of that. But we'd like to see that progressed as quickly as possible and have that time frame reduced if possible. So we will be liaising with RTE over this period to see if that can be done any quicker.
Yes, indeed. It certainly seems like a very long period of time for any radio service to be off the air. So you mentioned that you want to also explore alternatives to the long wave service into the future, if indeed there's no guarantee after 2 years. Does that mean looking again at the DAB, the digital radio option in the UK?
We'd be very open to any suggestions in relation. And again, our committee is very open to the members of the public contacting us in relation to their concerns. And if there are other digital solutions out there, other solutions in relation to better transmission, we would be open to that. So again, it's up to us as a committee to ensure that this service continues and to work with RTE in relation to finding those alternative solutions into the long term.
Deputy Hildegard Nocton, Chair of the Oireachtas Communications Committee, thank you very much for joining us today. And we should say that we asked a representative of RTE to come on this programme, but we received no response to our request.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
We've covered a lot of pirate radio history on this programme before, including the research of broadcast historian Eddie Bowen, whose new book on the history of Irish radio was launched in Dublin recently. The book is called A Century of Irish Radio, 1900 to 2000, and concentrates strongly on pirate radio history, particularly since the 1980s. We went along to the launch, which took place on April the 24th, the anniversary of a very important event in Irish radio history, as Eddie Bowen explained.
It's apt that I'm launching this book in this building, in this place, because 103 years ago, this week, about a dozen rebels took control of this corner and went up to the fourth floor and began broadcasting from the fourth floor, communiques written by Pierce, Plunkett and Connolly, which meant that Ireland became the first nation in the world to be declared by radio, which is quite unique, and there's no other country in the world can claim that. So it's kind of apt that the book gets launched here. It's also apt that this week, or this weekend, will be International Marconi Day at the weekend. For anybody who fancies making the way out to the hurdy-gurdy out in Holt, they have a big weekend out there. I want to actually just talk about, say a few thank yous, and the way I'm going to do that is with how, why, where and when. How I became mad about radio is thanks to two people. One of them is here today, my mother, whose birthday is tomorrow. So, happy birthday. And my father, who sadly passed away just over a year ago. But I grew up in a household with one telly, one radio, a radio too high up so I couldn't turn the dials, and a television I wasn't allowed to touch. But when I was young, my mother and father bought me a little orange transistor radio, and it changed my life. I actually still remember going up the first day and turning a little dial in the front of it and hearing these different languages, this different cultures, different sports, different news. And I was just hooked. Radio was just part of me. And then Dad came in with the Sunday World. It wasn't that long on the shelves, and there was a little article in it, about 76, 77, that this Radio Dublin was on the air on Sunday. And I was knew how to dial in to 253, and there was Radio Dublin. And again, I suddenly became hooked. I was an anorak. And from that point, I started to catalogue and work out where these stations were and what the stations were and what frequency they were on. Were they on every Sunday, only Saturdays? Were they only on for a few hours? And I was logging it down. And I started to put it all together. And years ago. And sisters just reminded me, as far as they can remember, I was writing the book. On pirate radio. I did, towards the late 80s, finish the book, again, thanks to Mammy, because she was able to type better than I could, and I couldn't, everything was longhand. I just mentioned earlier, longhand. When I was got involved in radio first, the only book that I ever came across about radio was Maurice Gorham's 1966 book, 40 Years of Irish Radio. Couldn't really afford a book, couldn't afford a photocopier because they weren't even invented. So I had, and I still have, loads of copybooks, school copybooks at home, where I longhand wrote out the whole book. I had the whole book, wrote it out longhand so I would have it. Which I still have, and I still, even though Maurice Gorham's book is totally inaccurate. But the reason I got to this point where I wanted to write it is partly then why. Why is huge to me? Irish radio is massive. There's loads of people here involved in radio, still involved in radio. Some of the great people, Declan, huge man in radio, so long in radio. Walter doing Christmas FM. Radio is part of our social history. Radio is a natural resource that we should remember, we should archive, we should hold up to the generations in front of us of what radio is and what radio was, so they can learn from it, and that we can continue to use radio as it is today, the most popular medium in Ireland. 85% of people in Ireland listen to radio every single day. Massive numbers. So that's partly why. And again, thanks to people like Declan over there, not enough has been written about pirates. Nothing. Peter Mulroyan's book, Radio Radio, back in the 80s, I think was the last big book on radio. So I was putting this together. The book kind of expanded into the more general history of Irish radio, because I discovered that, you know, stuff was coming online. I was over in the National Archives in Britain. More stuff was coming from them. So I was able to put this book together of not the stories that you can go to Wikipedia and find. There's stories in the book that you won't find on Wikipedia. Maybe you will tomorrow, but not today. So that's partly why. And I wanted to bring this book to fruition because I'm passionate about the history of radio. And it's thanks to Ian Bigger, because the DX archive inspired me. Because, and no disrespect to Ian, but Irish radio history should be archived by Irish people in Ireland, not by someone who came to us and on his own back archived it. And it's thanks to you that we have those archives. And future generations will thank you more than I can ever thank you. So, Ian, thank you. I know not just you, I should mention Gary, and you're not just you. But it inspired me to try and archive our own history. We have every other industry, military, government, everybody else archives, RTE archives, but pirate radio was never archived properly. And I appreciate that. And I was delighted then that Mark came on board last year with a bit of effort to put in the Irish Pirate Radio Archive out in DCU. So again, thank you for that.
Radio historian Eddie Bowen speaking at the launch of his book, A Century of Irish Radio, 1900 to 2000. And you can buy copies of the book on Amazon. One of those who attended the launch was Ian Bigger, an Irish pirate radio enthusiast who worked in several stations in the 1980s before returning to his native Scotland. As part of our work on the Irish Pirate Radio Audio Archive, myself and longtime friend of this programme, Brian Green, travelled to Harrogate in England recently to interview Ian about his radio memories. While in Ireland for the book launch, we brought Ian to the site of Boyneside Radio in Drogheda, one of the bigger regional stations of the 1980s, where he had worked. So this month, we thought it would be appropriate to include some of Ian's memories of Boyneside Radio. Boyneside Radio.
Off the ferry, the first place we headed was Drogheda, because we'd heard Boyneside Radio quite clearly in Scotland on 1305 kilohertz. They were running quite a few hundred watts at that time, so they were getting a relatively good signal into the west coast of the UK. So we headed up to Drogheda, but things were a bit strange because Boyneside Radio seemed to have disappeared from 1305 and had been replaced by a station called Community Radio Drogheda, with a lot of the same voices from Boyneside. So we weren't quite sure what had happened. As we approached Drogheda, our assumption before that was that Boyneside Radio had closed or had changed name or whatever. But as we approached Drogheda, we started hearing on FM Boyneside Radio. I think they were in 98.1 and 99.2 FM. But on 1305 was Community Radio Drogheda. So I think it occurred to us, you know, it's the age-old story in pirate radio, there's been a split of some sort, which indeed there had been. As we approached Drogheda, we started to hear Boyneside Radio on 1314 kilohertz AM, but they must have been putting out about 2 watts or something because it was barely covering Drogheda itself, the signal. It was a Peter Gibney rig, you know, and I don't know, you know, Peter obviously was very proficient in building transmitters, but I don't know what had gone wrong with this one, but its coverage was limited, to say the least. So it turns out Boyneside Radio were still on the air on FM and with this very low-powered transmitter on 1314 kilohertz. So we called in there and were given a really nice welcome by the guys in Boyneside. Showed around the station, showed the transmitters, taken on a tour of Drogheda to show us the other transmitter sites as well. And also sort of filled in, or got one side of the story as to why the stations had split. I sort of said to them at that point, look, yeah, I'm interested in working in radio. Is there any jobs going? And just because there'd been a split, there were shorter presenters at the time. And they said, well, yeah, well, why don't you just go up and make a demo tape in the studio at the moment and we'll see what it's like, you know? I said, well, I don't really have time to do that because we planned this tour of Ireland. When I get back home to Scotland, I'll send you a demo tape because I had a little studio in my bedroom. So we agreed on that. They said they could pay regular money. I think it was about 60 or 70 quid a week they offered at that time, which was enough to survive. So we then continued our tour of Ireland from Drogheda.
So you went back to Scotland then after the tour, and how long was it before you came back to Ireland full time?
So we got back middle of August, I think. So I made the tape pretty much straight away and sent it across to Boyneside, and within a day or so they phoned me up and said, yeah, you know, we're interested, would you come across? So within about a month I was over in Drogheda and working the station on Boyneside. It was quite interesting because at that time in Drogheda, I mean, you know, being where it is in the northeast of Ireland, there was quite a lot of at that time the H block thing was quite intense. There was a lot of there was demonstrations in Drogheda and so on. So it was quite an eye opener for me going over there to a town where this kind of thing that I didn't really know a lot about at that time was going on. And there was some sort of trepidation from that respect. But ultimately, you know, once you're with people who know the town and so on, and they help you to settle in fairly quickly. So I felt pretty welcome in Drogheda pretty much straight away.
And was the fact that you were a Scot, did that give you some sort of a protection, do you think, in Drogheda, or were people suspicious of the Scottish voice on air, or how did that go down?
Yeah, I think it went down okay. I don't think anybody was ever, nobody ever said anything to me if they were, I always felt pretty welcome. I don't think people would. I mean, Peter Madison, who sadly passed away a few weeks ago, Peter worked in Boyneside Radio for a year or so. And from what I understand, I mean, Peter, an English voice in Boyneside, nobody sort of batted an eyelid, sort of thing. I suppose at that time, though, it was different because, as I mentioned, the H Block thing was in full swing during the period I was there. But no, certainly nobody ever said anything to me, at that point.
Was Boyneside a particular station that was kind of a ground of kind of developing talent that went on to other stations?
Yeah, it was.
Was it like the group of people that were there? Tell us about them.
Yeah. I mean, Boyneside at that time, just to go back a bit, I always thought, the stations in Ireland that I'd like to work for, I mean, obviously there's Nova and Sunshine, but I didn't think I had the experience at that time to do that. I thought, well, ARD always sounds good, and Boyneside. Because, we used to be able to hear Boyneside in Scotland, as I mentioned earlier. They had jingles made by CPMG, which was a PAMS offshoot, which made the station sound good. So, I mean, it did sound quite together, and one of the better kind of regional stations, if you like, in Ireland. So, I mean, I was quite pleased that I was able to join the station. In terms of the people on air at the time, I mean, there was Eric Vaughan was there, who's now Eric Griffin on C103. Owen Larkin was there, who went on to Century Radio, and he's now working in the north of Ireland with City Beat, and he's also in 4FM at the moment as well, I think. So Owen went on to there. Darren Nelson, who went on to work on LMFM. So yeah, there was a lot of guys who moved on. Myself obviously went on to work in local radio in back in Scotland, So yeah, it was a lot of talented people there, yeah.
There was competition for Boyneside in its town, and obviously its name tells us that it's on the banks of the Boyne that runs through Drogheda, but there's, the northeast is, it's got carousels, it's got Telstars, there's other things going on, there's the CRD. Tell us a bit about the splits and the issues there.
Hmm. So the split happened, when I arrived there was two stations, well there was really three stations in Drogheda. There was Boyneside, there was Community Radio Drogheda, and Radio Carousel also had a transmitter, although it mainly relayed at that time the Dundalk output. So, I mean, the main competition for advertising was between Boyneside Radio and Community Radio Drogheda. The camps had kind of split. I mean, Gavin Duffy and Eddie Caffrey and Richard Crowley and a few others had gone to join CRD. And people like Eric Vaughan and Darren Nelson had stayed with Boyneside. So, the sort of talent pool had split down the middle, if you like. Each had their own kind of following. So there was big rivalry in the town at the time for advertising. There was, undercuts happening, advertising being sold for like a pound a slot kind of thing, just to get advertising in. I think Ebon McDonnell, who owned Boyneside, his answer to the competition was to try and take an extra step. So he seemed to think starting a television station would help the profile of Boyneside Radio in the town. So that happened around about November, I think it was, 1981. A television transmitter was brought in from Italy, I think it was. Just a small unit. It wasn't very powerful, something like 10 watts, 20 watts or whatever. A TV studio of sorts was built. It was quite an intrigue because it was very much a Heath McIntosh effect. They didn't really have a vision mixer as such. They used to switch between sources by using buttons from a television. So you press a button and it would switch from camera to camera kind of thing. So it was very, very, very basic.
They call that a jump cut on YouTube now, wouldn't they?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And were you involved in the television service? Were you presenting on air then as well?
Presenting on air, yeah. Well, what they used to do was put the camera into the radio studio. So they'd actually film you doing your radio show.
It's very forward thinking when you think of the use of social media today. But was there ever an intention to make it anything other than a television feed of what the radio was doing?
Oh, it was, yeah. They had separate programmes. Now, let me think back. So I think when we first started, we broadcast in the evening. The television station probably opened up about 5 o'clock when I was on Boyneside Radio doing the feed, as I mentioned earlier. Then there'd be a news broadcast, I think it's 6:15. So the newsreaders would be shown on screen on Boyneside Television. Then there was a sports report. And following that, there'd be like a local documentary, a local film or whatever, you know. The most ironic that I can remember was at the time there was interference between the television and the radio station, so we couldn't broadcast separate programs in Boyneside Radio while the film or the documentary or whatever was going out at the television station. So we had to carry the audio of Boyneside Television on radio. So I remember one, and it sounds absolutely daft now. There was a film of a basketball match, a local basketball match in Drogheda, without any commentary. So all you heard on Boyneside Radio for about half an hour was da-dum, 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 hey! Da-dum, da-dum, da-dum. And that was it for half an hour, you know. So
it was never really a serious operation then, was it?
It was never. They had a few adverts, you know. Yeah. It was never really a serious operation. If you want my own personal view, I thought it was an absolute waste of time. Yeah. And they'd been better investing money in the radio station, getting a bigger transmitter, getting better studio equipment, rather than wasting money that they did on a TV station that was Mickey Mouse, to say the least, you know.
What was the camaraderie like between the DJs between stations? Like, would you visit the other stations, socialise with the jocks from across town?
No. In Drogheda, no. I'll come on to that later. When we moved to Cork, I'll come on to that because it's quite different there. But in Drogheda, no, there was an absolute divide between Boyneside Radio and CRD. I think it was quite an acrimonious split. I wasn't there when the split happened, but I think there was some bad feeling, shall we say.
Did the split fix itself up? Like, did Gavin Duffy return to Boyneside's family?
No, Gavin didn't, but I'll come to that as we go along. Yeah, we'll sort of repair it all back round again, you know. The split happened. We didn't really socialise. Although in saying that, Eric Vaughan at the time shared a house with Gavin Duffy and Richard Crowley. So often we got there after the pub, you know, and we'd have a few jars and so on. So I mean, there was some sort of socialising, I suppose, from that point of view. But other than meeting up in the house, in the DJ house, we didn't really meet down the pub or anything like that, you know.
Was there big money being made? Was the bank runs like need armed protection? Was there money being made here?
I think when Boyneside Radio was on there on its own in Drogheda, there was money being made. I think when the station split, there was less money being made, and it was, you know, it was obviously being split down the middle. Because Boyneside Radio, Community Radio Drogheda, Joe Public didn't know which one was which, really, you know. They'd tune into 225, and they'd hear Radio Drogheda and think, oh, that's Boyneside. They'd hear Eddie Caffrey's voice, and there was no, I don't think there was any listener loyalty between one station or the other. They just had a voice they liked.
It was the local station.
That's right, yeah. They just had a voice they liked. So I think advertising kind of waned off a little bit at that time in the town, because people were just booking with the station they thought they was, you know, Boyneside Radio. And it may have been CRD, it may have been Boyneside, you know.
It sounds like what was happening in Dublin. Like, the average listener might not have known that it was ARD, Radio Dublin, or Big D they were listening to. They were listening to a jock that was on one station one week, and he might have moved because of a split, or because he got a better offer, or he couldn't put up with the management in some place. So I suppose it was a kind of a copy of, you know, the listener didn't really know the brand, and there was entertainment on the air, but maybe as the salespeople hit the streets, they had to convince the shops and whatever to spend the money with their station as opposed to the other.
That's pretty much it, yeah. I think I'm pretty sure that nobody knew the difference between Boyneside and Community Radio Drogheda at that particular time, you know.
And when did the split resolve itself, or when did, you know, Community Radio Drogheda cease to exist?
So I think Community Radio Drogheda, by April 82, was having some real difficulties, financial difficulties, and was on the verge of closing down. So Gavin pulled the plug, and he and Richard Crowley moved to Radio Leinster. Eddie Caffrey and the rest of the Drogheda guys then were welcomed back by Yvonne McDonald. So they went, you know, despite the fact saying that they would never work again together, eventually they did, you know, which was a good thing for the radio station and for the town, you know. By that time I had left, I had gone, you know. But they resolved it about April 82.
Irish pirate radio enthusiast Ian Bigger talking to Brian Green and myself about his memories of Louth pirate station Boyneside Radio. And you can hear that full interview on pirate.ie.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
Wax cylinders, vinyl, cassettes and digital. Sound has been recorded in various formats for well over a century, and preserving radio memories and historical recordings is inseparable from format. It can be challenging to access working equipment to play particular historical recordings, and the issue of format obsolescence is always in the background for anyone interested in radio or audio history. Andy O'Dwyer works at the University of Luxembourg and specialises in formats.
Yes, I actually joined the BBC in 1986 and worked there for 29 years doing preservation of audiovisual material. There's a lot of material there, as you'd expect, radio history recorded onto various formats. So over my employment with the BBC, I was used to handling quite old formats and modern formats for preservation.
Can you give us an example of some of the old formats that you were handling, some of the earlier methods of recording radio?
Yes, as some people may know, that a lot of radio was actually recorded onto disc. And in the very early days, that was a good way of recording. And later on, people will be familiar with quarter-inch reel-to-reel recorders. There is a two-inch format as well. And during my period, we would look at re-recording these onto digital formats for long-term preservation.
And was it relatively easy to deal with, say, the reel-to-reel format, given that it was so common for so long, or were there other formats in that period that were more complicated to preserve for the current day?
Yes, reel-to-reel recordings are probably one of the easier ones because it's a visual medium. You're actually used to using it all the time. It was around for a very long time, so there were plenty of machines to replay the format. One of the issues with it is that if it's not stored correctly, is that it can actually decay. So one of the jobs early on was to actually identify the most at-risk material and then actually form a preservation plan to actually preserve that material ahead of your everyday library archive.
And what about the cassette then? Obviously the cassette emerged. What period would we have been talking about, and for how long was it dominant?
The cassette that I knew of was from 70s onwards, but there were earlier, much earlier examples, of course. One of the issues with cassettes is actually the rewinding of the spool. Many spools are actually, just like at home, in fact, people wouldn't fully rewind a tape. And so you would get a tape with a kind of print, if you like, and it would actually be twisted inside. So a lot of that was about taking the cassette apart, rewinding it, actually checking that it's good, cleaning it, and then moving it over to a digital recording.
Did you come across during your period at the BBC examples of formats that couldn't be preserved, that couldn't be salvaged, that there was no technology available, looking at the early period, for instance?
I didn't have experience of that myself, but I had heard from former engineers that there had been problems with early formats. I think some of the vinyl could be recovered, but it took a long time. For example, if you have a vinyl that's been cracked, it can be extremely difficult to recover the whole program. But as people may know, that using lasers, you can recover from vinyl much more than you can with a traditional needle.
And moving towards the digital age, what are the challenges in media preservation of formats that are digital from their instigation?
Yeah, really the big risk for people in the professional world as well as at home are the early digital formats where there are not devices to replay them. So, for example, things like mini disc, although they're still around and you can buy them, collectors can buy them, actually material stored on those can be difficult to transfer over.
Another example that you mentioned before was DAT. It was a rather short-lived format as well. So is the issue here with formats that are short-lived, not whether they're digital or analog, but that they were relatively short in their popularity and therefore there weren't enough apparatus, wasn't enough apparatus around to use today? Is that the explanation for this problem?
Yes, exactly. That is one of the key issues, is that formats are very short-lived. I think the average life, and I'm being very approximate here, for particularly in the professional world, can sometimes be 5 or 6 years. And so people invest in a technology. Sometimes it can be that the software or the spare parts for machines don't exist anymore. And then we've had to source those from abroad. So we have format obsolescence where the hardware doesn't exist. But in the professional world as well, well, you also have skills, a lack of skills, where people have retired. And so the people who used to maintain equipment in the professional world, who are used to keeping them running, if you like, they retire. And we're very much reliant on the old knowledge from people.
And can I ask you what your day-to-day work then in this area involves here at the University of Luxembourg?
Yes, my role as head of the Digital History Lab is to actually provide a set of tools for students to use. So we, as we've been doing this week, we've been using old radios, old technology, to get students to actually appreciate the materiality, how things were put together, how they were constructed, the taking apart a radio, for example, and actually seeing the valves, looking at the, if you like, all the little hardware bits, how it was put together, and actually how ingenious it was that people overcame many problems.
Do you have a favourite apparatus here in the among the radio sets that we've seen this week? For instance, one that you think is particularly ingenious or particularly sophisticated for its era?
Yes, I like wax cylinders. We have a collection here, and we actually, people may be interested to know that we actually have recorded onto wax cylinder and actually played it back and recorded it back to digital. So we've actually gone from really old technology and recorded on old technology and actually put it into a modern era, and it is a really nice experience.
So that you had students recording on a wax cylinder today and then you digitized the recording?
Yes, that's right. We actually had had somebody on Skype who was a skilled person at this, who supplied us with the hardware, and we did a recording. And it was a really, really good way of learning for students.
Students must find it incredible to be dealing with these very early formats. Students who are only used to digital formats, digital natives, they must find it incredible to deal with the earlier ways of recording sound on radio.
Yes, and one of the things which is really good to see is that people are starting to appreciate radio, and that actually doing something like this, is which is really hands-on, it's nothing to do with the digital in the early stages of the recording, and it actually lets them appreciate how the technology of radio has advanced.
Andy O'Dwyer, thanks very much for joining us on Wireless on Flirt FM.
And thank you again.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
The 45th International Feature Conference was held last month in the village of Castle Martyr in East Cork. The IFC is a free 4-day event and forum for audio makers who love the art and craft of radio documentaries and features. Each year, a different European public broadcaster holds the event, and this year's conference was hosted by RTE. From its modest beginnings in 1974, the IFC has met once a year to celebrate what its website refers to as the highest forms of factual radio. The event is attended by audio producers from all over Europe, and among those in Castle Martyr this year was Flirt FM manager Paula Healy, who's in studio now. Hi Paula.
Hi John, how are you getting on?
Very well, thanks. Can you tell us what the IFC means by the highest forms of factual radio?
I suppose everybody knows what a documentary is. They're often underfunded, like the poor cousin of everything else in the station. But I suppose for Irish people, we know better than most because we have the fantastic Doc on One series. It's not just, here are the facts, here's some exposition. It's the... it's kind of the pinnacle of it, like the best laid out, the most artistic, while still getting across information. It could be so many different things, and there were so many different kinds of features, as they call them, or documentaries. And you could definitely tell from country to country what their style was, but it was huge. So, it's basically anything that is telling a story that is factual, and it can be told in so many different ways. They can be lyrical, they can be very straightforward, they can be dense, they can be sparse. So I learned so much at this conference.
But it's not factual, it's not news, it's not current affairs, it's more artistic than that.
It would be. It's telling a story. It's going out and documenting something that actually happened. It's not fiction. But some people were arguing that if you put any artistic license into something that's current affair, like that is actually something, it's no longer current affairs, it is now fiction. And a lot of people were arguing, no, I'm like, it's still truthful. You've gone out and you've got documentary first-hand or second-hand evidence of something. You've researched it and you've tried to convey a story. And often the stories are so long and so complicated that you have to take a bit of license in actually trying to tell the stories. Some of the stories I was listening to took place over decades. So, of course, you can't just sit there and, like, you know, exposit and just, like, just here's A, B, C, D, E, F, G. So, I don't know. We'd a lot of lively discussion about what actually constituted it as well, definitely.
And tell me, what kind of people attend then? Is it a mixture of community, commercial, public service broadcasters?
Well, this was the first year that I'd ever gone to it. It's hosted by the European Broadcasting Union, the people behind the Eurovision, of course, which we heard the Eurovision theme tune quite a lot over the week. it's been hosted by RTÉ, and I have to say RTÉ played an absolute blinder. They did such a good job. I couldn't have been prouder. And the effort that went into it was insane. It did seem to be some freelancers, a lot of people working with state broadcasters, and not so much commercial, because I think commercial, maybe it might have had, I suppose the likes of commercial might have some independent funding. Like for us, it's Sound and Vision. It's usually like the commercials aren't really focusing on doing features themselves. They just outsource them. And this was the first year where RTÉ just went to the absolutely, we're delighted to invite community radio. And even in the opening address, they specifically said, we really think that, you know, we have a lot to be learned and a lot to gain from actually inviting community radio and having that dialogue open. And
good to get that recognition. So,
and it was good, but my favourite thing about it was, so you had people from the BBC, you had people from the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, people from Australia, China, all over the world, but everybody was a peer. Everybody's treated at the same level, and all of their inputs and all of their contributions were just treated with the same respect. And I was like, wow, okay, great, lovely. It's really, really nice to have.
And how good was the spread of countries represented then?
So there was some people from America, some from Canada, Australia, China. I like was actually very surprised to have there, and a lot of people were delighted to have some Chinese broadcasters. A lot of Eastern Europe coming into Germany. Not so many from France or Italy. There were some Italian people there for the handover to next year's. And there was a lot of UK people and a good few Irish people as well. So that was kind of what I think was the makeup of the crowd. Yeah.
So was a lot of the material then in other languages, or was English predominant?
Oh, it was definitely. When you are allocated a space at the conference, you're given some pre-listening to do. So we had to listen to four features each. We're divided up into 10 different groups. My group got two pieces in German with some Hungarian translated, and another piece in Dutch, and then one piece in English. And it was actually quite heavy going reading the transcripts while you're listening to this. And also one of the pieces in German, it was great, it's lovely to listen to, but one of the pieces in German, the other piece in German was about microcomputing in East Germany in the 80s. It was incredibly dense and very, very tough to get through. It was interesting, but my God, it was like a lot of reading and a lot of understanding.
But you had a translation, did
you? We had a translation. Oh, good luck, I couldn't have gotten through it without that. So it was very, very interesting to read that. One thing I have to give a shout out to though, and I think because I hadn't been at IFC before, I didn't realise how much effort they'd put into it, but the people that had actually translated all the pieces for the big screen, there was an audio cinema. It was basically like in the function room where you'd have the wedding reception or whatever. So everybody would sit in there and listen to pieces, and some of them were in English, some of them were in other languages, especially the Chinese one, of course. But when we're watching it, they actually had subtitles done up on a black screen, but they hadn't got a program to do it. They'd had somebody from IADT, as far as I know, sitting there and timing them But the woman who did it, she timed them so beautifully that you even forgot that you were reading.
Okay.
You're listening to Chinese, or you're listening to German, or you're listening to Swedish, and you kind of just forgot. Because
it was so well done.
It was so well done. So I have to say hats off. And I know from working on that kind of project, that must have taken days, weeks for that person to do. So there was so many things about this that were excellent. It was just like one of the best conferences I've ever been to, actually. So
great. And yeah. Tell us about the relationship then with Hearsay, because we're also talking about the Hearsay Audio Festival in Kilfinan in Limerick in this month's edition of Wireless. And of course, the IFC, the International Features Conference, just followed on the hot on the heels from the Hearsay Audio Festival. So plenty of choice for people interested in high-end features and documentaries and creative use of audio in general.
It was very interesting for a couple of different reasons. One, devastated not to get to Hearsay myself, but it was the end of college term, so I just couldn't do it. And I had been to the previous iterations of it, so I could see lots of people turning up from Hearsay a little bit tired, but excited. And, you know, they'd had a very fulfilling couple of days. The IFC had actually changed their dates so that it ran just directly after Hearsay, which worked because you had a lot of international guests that were coming over for Hearsay that went straight into IFC. I'm sure they were shattered by the end of it. So that was excellent. And
what do you think would be the difference between the two?
So I think I'd say Hearsay definitely is more into sound art, as opposed to just audio pieces that you could definitely put on the radio that actually have information in them, because Hearsay might have more experiences and have stranger locations, and it's spread out around the town and everything, and it's very interactive, and it's like you wander around and you find, and there's a sense of discovery, whereas IFC is more meditative, and you sit there and you will interact with people and have breakouts, but it's definitely more of a conference, which it was actually really nice to be, because we're also addicted to smartphones, and I've got the attention span of a goldfish. It's really nice to just be forced to sit in a room and listen to a piece of wonderful audio.
As you said, it's like an audio cinema, so you have to turn off your phone like you would in the actual cinema.
And even though they had fantastic speakers and the sound was amazing and the engineers from RT were phenomenal, and they'd really, you know, they spent time setting it up, they also gave you the option of having wireless headphones to actually just envelop yourself in that little world itself. And considering the one of the things, the speakers got, like, they got really, really tested, because Chris Watson, who does sound with Attenborough, like the BBC nature programmes, he actually brought in recordings of blue whales and all of these other things that he'd done. And Mike, this is pushing speakers and surround sound systems to the extremes and the limits. And he said, like, he'd actually played to the blue whale. He had to speed it up so you could even hear it because it was so subsonic. But in this case, he said, like, he'd played it in another place and the windows were rattling and he thought they were going to break. And they, like, I have to say, the RT engineers did such a good job on this. They really, really did.
Great. So can you tell us about some of your favourite pieces then from the International Features Conference?
I really enjoyed one piece that I was listening to. It was from BBC. It was called The Patch. And it's a series where the producer, basically, I've forgotten her surname, but her name is Polly, and she's great fun. Herself and her producer back at base decided that they were going to do a lottery of a postcode in the UK, and whatever turned up, she's going to have to go there and find a story. And in the piece that we got to listen to, and it's available, it's she ended up going to a remote part of Scotland where there was very little happening at all. But was there? There actually, she got a story, and it was fantastic. I think the things that worked out really, really well that everybody ended up absolutely loving, and I'm pretty sure you can listen to this online. And I know the BBC Sounds app, but it might be available other places. It's a piece from BBC Radio 4 called Searching for Swimming Pools, and I think everybody just fell in love with it. They thought it was absolutely brilliant. It's about a man who used to just go sea swimming, but in his old age, he actually has Alzheimer's. He's remembering bits and pieces. They go back to, he'd written a book about it in the 70s, so they'd gone back, and then you know, he'd had readings from it back then. And I think, like, everybody in the conference, like, unanimously were like, This piece is absolutely fantastic.
Great. So we hear a lot about the future of radio and the threat to the medium and so on. But, like, from your experience of IFC and previously of Hearsay, do you think that this kind of stuff is the future? Is this what will save the medium of radio, this high-end audio, this creative, different, niche material?
I think so, because it's the kind of thing something that's very you can listen back to it and it's very podcastable after the fact, because I mean the Doc on One has huge listenership, and I'm like, I don't know if they've moved it to the weird slot on Saturdays instead of Sundays, which doesn't make sense, but the app and the fact that you can download it as a podcast is huge. It's absolutely massive, and I think I'd be so surprised if any of these don't end up online for you to listen back in your own time. It's just there's so many young people at this as well, people that were just starting off in the industry and they're so excited about it. But the thing is, people are decrying the end of radio as a medium, but the truth is it's remarkably resilient, and that all of this is just getting more creative because they know that, yes, you've got your piece, it's going to go out on FM, that's great, but it's got a second life after it as well, and it can reach so much further than your FM goes. But it was very interesting to note that podcasts and these features are a different beast. They don't sound the same, you don't structure them the same, and you can definitely tell, and that there needs to be a space for these kind of features because they're more artistic, they're more meditative, they're more enveloping, and there's just something about them that's more intimate.
It's like the slow food movement, perhaps.
It is. It definitely is.
And slow audio.
It was such a good break for my brain. As somebody who listens to 45 podcasts, sometimes sped up for the American slow talkers, it was so good for me to just take a break and slow down and actually really, really appreciate these pieces of, I guess, the works of art in their own way.
But are you going to tell us about the Wick language?
It's very unusual. I'd never heard of it before myself. And it ended up being more of a love story than anything else. It was very, very interesting. But definitely enjoyed that very much. There was little bits of the language in it, and
this is an Aboriginal language, presumably in Australia.
It is. I literally had never heard of it before, but that was just a tiny part of it. It was definitely, there was a culture clash, there's a love story, and there was a wonderful producer and narrator that she was actually Georgia. She was actually at the festival as well. But it would do it a disservice. I'd actually, if I told you too much about that piece before you listened, it would probably ruin it for you. So I will definitely send you on a link if I can find a link to any of these, probably put them on the blog, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah. So next year's IFC, International Features Conference, then?
It's being hosted in Rome. There was a handover to RAI in Rome, and it's going to be happening there. I would love to go myself. It's free to attend, but you need to pay your own travel and accommodation. Now, this year, there was 220 people at it, which was significantly more than usual, probably because of the extra people from Hearsay. I'm not sure if they'll have that capacity, and I feel like a little bit of imposter syndrome because I don't actually make features myself very often. I have done in the past, but they're very workmanlike. So I feel a little bit of an imposter heading along, but I really, really enjoyed and got a lot out of this festival, or this conference, I have to say.
Okay, Paula Healy, Flirt FM manager, just back from the International Features Conference in Castlemartre. Thanks very much for talking to us on Wireless.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
The Hearsay International Audio Arts Festival was mentioned in that interview with Paula Healy, so our final item this month brings you a flavour of what happened in the tiny village of Kilfinan in County Limerick, where the festival was held. The fourth Hearsay Festival took place from April the 4th to the 7th and featured radio and audio makers from around the world. Brian Green was there for Wireless.
Flirt FM Galway, this is Wireless, and I'm talking with Leela Day, and Leela is the producer and co-host of the Stoop podcast and senior producer at Pineapple Media, and you're soon to be a presenter of a new Stoop Talks podcast with Luminary. You're welcome to Wireless.
Thank you.
I saw your talk on Thursday night at the Hearsay Audio Arts Festival in Kilfinan, and it really did chime with me that you take risks in radio. Tell us about taking risks and putting yourself into the story.
I actually just think that, like, for me personally, I'm tired of not taking risks in the stories that I'm making, and I just feel that for me that's what it's all about. You know, right now I just kind of want to really challenge myself and how to tell a story and what is contentious about it and how can I tell something very delicate in a way that's kind of palatable for listeners. I put myself in some of the pieces and in quite a few of them because I just feel like there's a lot of personal reaction from people that really touches something within them to feel that, oh, I experienced that too, or oh, I've thought that, but I've never been able to articulate it, or I would have never been able to say that out in the open. So I'm all about being able to create things that'll cause like conversation and reflection. And I think that's why I put myself in some of these pieces, because I do want people to think like, it's not just you, you know, that has had this thought or has had this happen to them. And let's kind of just talk about it.
You may have heard this question on Thursday night and it might have come from me. And that was, are you fearless or are you brave? So do you just, have you lost fear or are you brave to fight through and take these risks?
I think it was you that asked me that, maybe. In terms of being fearless or brave, honestly, I do have fear sometimes. Like there are times that I'll make something and I'll say it and I'll say, wait, is that how I wanted to say that? Is that what I want to say? Do I want to put that out there? I definitely have those moments. So I wouldn't say I'm fearless, but I would say like I'm pretty brave in the sense that I do take those risks and I'll be like, well, you know, if people are going to say this about me or think that, then so be it. Because, you know, I think that's the problem right now is that we're just not talking about these things. And we need to talk about them in a way that, you know, opens up the dialogue. So I would say like, yeah, I think we all have fear, like making the things, right? It's your heart you're putting out there, it's your reputation. So I wouldn't say, I do feel like everyone has fear. If they say they don't, then I think they might not be telling the truth.
So not being risk averse, do you find that when you are risky, there's no downside risk? That it wasn't there in the first place, really?
That's a great question. I mean, I do feel that we do put up these like walls and these, you know, kind of barriers, and we think a lot about how a story is supposed to be told before we even make it. And I do feel that if you start to just make it and you start to just talk and you start to, you know, sometimes some of us gather tape and we have interviews and we talk to people and we hold on to it for you know, something that we were like, oh, I'm going to make this next month. And you hold on to it for another month. And then another month becomes a year. And then before you know it, you have like this interview that you really want to get out there that you've been holding on to for 4 years. I do think like it's all about when you want to take the risk, because I feel like it's there. You know you want to make it and you know you're willing to make it. It's just a matter of like, are you ready? Are you ready to make it, you know? And for me, it's not necessarily about like the subject matter being tough. It might just be like, do I have like the mental bandwidth to produce something of this magnitude, you know?
And do you find that in growing as a radio producer and taking on these bigger stories, that in doing them, you grow broader shoulders and you can do the next bigger thing? Do you feel that?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Like this, a lot of the pieces that I've done that have been a little bit more like heavily reported have definitely put me in this space. Like, I really want to do long form. I really want to do long form documentary. I'd love to do investigative work. It's like little by little, you're just getting stronger and stronger at the craft. And I got into this a little over 5 years ago, you know, so I don't have years and years of radio under my belt, but what I do have is years and years of like thinking and making and thinking some more and talking to people and you just make it, you know. We're Hearsay, and there was, you know, a talk about just, you know, interviewing people just for the sake of speaking with them and getting to know them. And there's something like really beautiful about that. And a skill that if you have, like, you can always make something, you know?
Tell us about The Stoop podcast.
The Stoop is stories from across the Black diaspora. So we talk about all those things that might be really difficult to talk about and things that aren't talked about enough. So, like, the question, is it appropriation for an African-American to be wearing African clothing and not know the meaning behind it? Or why is it so difficult for a lot of Black parents to say, I love you? Or, you know, what is the story behind like natural hair? Like, is it something that all women should be doing? Or what are hijabi women doing about natural hair? So like things that are a little bit weird to talk about, we try to talk about them lightly.
Lelia Day of the Stoop podcast talking to Brian Green at the Hearsay International Audio Arts Festival in Limerick. And we'll have a longer report from Hearsay next month. And that brings us to the end of this month's edition of Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. We'll be back in June with the final programme in this series. I hope you'll join us then, but in the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt and on facebook.com/wirelessflirt. Until the next edition of Wireless, this is John Walsh wishing you good listening.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.